Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Jimmy Carter was a lot more than a president. He was a Sunday school teacher, a carpenter for Habitat for Humanity, a frequent visitor to McDonald's, and a Willie Nelson fan. But as much as anything, he was a fisherman. Carter and a small group of friends, including his wife, Rosalind, traveled all over the United States and all over the world to fly fish for trout, salmon, tarpon, or whatever else was below the surface. One of Carter's friends was Carlton Hicks, an eye doctor from St. Simon's Island on the Georgia coast, which happens to be where I come from. Hicks and Carter told their fishing stories to author Jim Barger Jr., who compiled them into a new book called Rivers and Dreams. Barger talked with me about how Carter used fishing as a tool for diplomacy, how he always seemed to end up catching the biggest fish, and how the former president and first lady used to squabble over Walmart. Here's our conversation. Jim Barger, let's just start simple. How did this book come about?
It came about because of fishing buddies swapping fishing stories on the stream side on the porch. The story, that's the short answer. The long answer is back in 1981, right after the Carters lost the presidency, they were back in Plains and pretty despondent over having lost the presidency and thinking about their accomplishments being rolled back and really just having felt resoundingly rejected by the American people. I mean, they didn't just lose, they lost big. In May of that year, they loaded up a camper van with Amy, Rosalind, and Jimmy, and they drove up to Spruce Creek, Pennsylvania to their friend Wayne Harpster's farm. That became an annual tradition. It was a place they recharged. It was one of the first places they recharged and thought about what they might do after the presidency. They took with them every year a guy from here who was a dear friend of mine, Dr. Carlton Hicks. He was a local optometrist who had helped Carter and been friends with Carter since he was a state senator through his first failed gubernatorial campaign and then his win for governor and then campaigned for him, suspended his practice, and campaigned for him all over the country. All those years, they fished every year in May at Spruce Creek, right up until the pandemic. And during the pandemic, it was clear that they couldn't really, at their age, afford to take any risks and go. So Dr. Hicks and my father, Jim Barger Sr., and a friend of ours, another friend of ours, Tom Sayer from St. Simon's, who's a local dentist. We went up there. We fished with the president's fishing rod, and we fished with his hand-tied flies, taking turns, catching fish, and listening to these stories. And it was there that Dr. Hicks and I decided, and we kept that tradition and have continued to go back. We decided we need to get these stories down.
So one thing I noticed right off the bat is that there's so many stories of Jimmy Carter bragging about having caught the most fish or the biggest fish or, you know, whatever it was on a given trip. And I wonder if you were able to figure out whether that was just kind of normal trash talk among fishermen or whatever, or whether he was actually that competitive.
He was incredibly competitive, I will tell you that. So was Rosalind. They were competitive with one another in angling and in politics and everything else that they did. But and he actually did catch most of the best fish on these trips. Now, one thing to bear in mind is when you're the president of the United States, the guides tend to want to get you on the best fish first, right? So the playing field wasn't exactly fair. But I will say, separate from that, President Carter was such a hard-working person, going back to his childhood in the Great Depression, getting up 4 a.m. to work on the farm, living in a place with no running water, no indoor plumbing. One of the first jobs he had as a child every morning was to go down and empty his great aunt's bedpan and feed the chickens, all of these things. So he couldn't sit. He was the kind of person who couldn't sit still for very long unless he was reading or something like that, but he or bird watching or hunting. But he had to be out on the water. So he was the first one out. Everyone always said, he, no matter how hard you tried to beat him to get out on the water before him, he was always the first one out and the last one in. And that last trip to Russia, he turned 90 that year that they fished in for Atlantic salmon. Up there in the Arctic Peninsula, it doesn't get dark till 2 a.m. And he would be up early in the morning as soon as it got daylight fishing, and he would be out till 2 a.m. at, you know, the year he turned 90.
I also noticed a theme of sort of, I guess, for lack of a better word, escape. Mm-hmm. There's a story in this book that I'll let you flesh out, but there's a moment when the Carters and I think some of their friends are watching Ronald Reagan give a speech where he rips into Carter pretty hard. And then they look around and all of a sudden, like, Jimmy's gone.
Yep.
Could you kind of fill out the rest of that story?
Sure. So they were on Sapelo Island, which is the island just north of where I live on St. Simons. And Sapelo is only accessible by ferry. And I'm sure you've been over there, but for your listeners, it's a very wild place. It's also one of the places that has the last intact Gullah Geechee community that is on a barrier island separated without a causeway. They were over there trying to sort of get away at the end of that. They used Sapelo in the first year and the last year, not really much in between. But in that last year, they were there contemplating things. And in that summer, at the Republican convention, President Reagan was really giving President Carter a hard time. And it was just Dr. Hicks and Rosalind huddled around the small television set there. But when they turned around, President Carter wasn't there. And afterwards, Dr. Hicks found him over by a table with his fly tying vise out, and he was quietly tying flies. And Carlton said, well, you know, you didn't want to see what they had to say. And he said, no, I know what they have to say. I need to think about what I need to do.
So you talk about time flies and fly fishing. Most of this book is about fly fishing trips, the vast majority of it. Mm-hmm. I assume that's the main way he fished. Like, he didn't do a lot of fishing with spinning rods and that sort of thing.
Well, I think the president was a lot like myself, which is he liked to catch fish. you know, you have your purists who are just fly fishing or just topwater, you know, dry flies. Or within fly fishing, there are purists' levels of purity, right? I would not characterize the president as a purist in that sense.
I want to get an idea of what it was like on those trips, because sounded like not only were he and his friends along, but even in his post-presidential life, there were like Secret Service agents and people like that along. So was there, on these trips, it sounded like there was a pretty big entourage most of the time.
Yeah, I it's not as big as the entourages that follow presidents now.
Right.
But certainly the Secret Service was with them on every trip. Some, usually the same Secret Service agents were part of those trips. And, you know, at back in Plains, they had Secret Service agents that lived adjacent to their home. But the entourage otherwise was fairly small on most of the trips. You had a few Secret Service agents, and you had the same 4 fishing buddies, which included President Carter and their spouses. Among the spouses, Rosalind was also one of the fishing buddies, if not fishing buddy number one. She was, but the other 3 spouses were not anglers. They tended to come along for the trip. Sometimes they weren't there, sometimes they were there. So you'd probably have anywhere between, you know, as little as six or eight people, and it may be twice that at the different trips. And then depending on where they went, the security was much higher. So when they went to Venezuela at a time of upheaval in that country, and part of the reason for the trip was for the president to spend time fishing with and talking with Gustavo Cisneros, who was the capitalist powerhouse in that country, if not all over South America at that time, and Hugo Chavez. So he was there trying to use his casual fishing trip to help broker a peace between these two sort of warring factions within the country. And he was actually successful at doing that. But of course, there were riots in the street at that time. And so they had State Department people with them on that trip, and they had Secret Service on that trip. And then they also had Venezuelan security with them on that trip. So that, you know, that trip would be much different than, say, just your standard fishing trip that they might only have a few folks with them.
It just struck me as how odd it must be to be on a trip where you're kind of, the point is to kind of get away from it all.
Yeah.
And to be out at some, you know, some creek somewhere. And you know, even though you might not be able to see them, there's like Secret Service aides hiding in the bushes somewhere.
Yeah, there's a moment in the book where I chronicle Dr. Hicks's early trip, one of his early trips to Spruce Creek with the president. And he's running along. Dr. Hicks was an avid jogger for most of his life. So was the president. But he'd gotten up early in the morning and he was jogging along the creek, which is this very pastoral setting. You've got dairy cows on the hillside. It's very green, not like our mountain streams, but more like an English chalk stream that you might imagine. As you run along and as you fish along that stream, one of the things I always think of, it comes right back to me, is that there's a lot of wild mint along the stream. And so when you walk, it just perfumes the air. It's a heavenly place and it's very peaceful. And he said he was jogging along and he came up around a bend and he looked up on the hillside where there were dairy cattle. And there were also two Apache helicopters sitting there, and there were people patrolling, you know, with sidearms. And he realized, you know, he remembered, my friend is actually the president of the United States. and these things are following us everywhere. We're not just fishing buddies.
You mentioned that, how he kind of doubled up on that trip to Venezuela and tried to do some diplomacy as well as catch some fish. Mm-hmm. It seemed like that happened quite a bit on some of these trips, where either he went with a dual purpose or maybe noticed something while he was there that he came back and dealt with later. Have I got that right?
That's true. You know, a great example was when they went to Honduras. They were bone fishing down there. And this is after Hurricane Mitch that came through in 1999, which devastated that country. Most of the mangrove forests, the forests that grow in the estuaries there that support migratory bird life, but also it's where tarpon and snook and all sorts of fish species have their hatchery and they spawn. I mean, it's critical. Mangroves are critical to the entire planet. And the mangroves down there had been decimated, and yet, you know, these were of critical importance. The Carters saw that, recognized that, and they spent a few days actually going in and plant with a group that was trying to reforest that area and hand planted themselves. And they went back to do that over time and became aware of the global significance of mangrove forests and how fragile they are.
It also seemed like he ended up, you know, a lot of these trips, either beforehand or after he made them, preserving a lot of the natural areas in those places. And obviously not just those places, but I think of Alaska, where he ended up making a huge deal to preserve so much of Alaskan land as natural, even though sort of the elected officials and a lot of people there were totally against that, right?
Every president prior to him struggled with the Alaska issue. What do we do with these wild spaces after Alaska became a state? And how do we balance the rights of indigenous people, the natural landscape, and the desire to, you know, advance the American economy? And he did a magnificent job of that. In fact, one of the things Senator Stevens at the time, longtime senator for Alaska.
Yeah, Ted Stevens.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
He was opposed, adamantly opposed to the Alaska Lands Deal, which is what they called that, you know, colloquially called the act that Carter passed. And but he tried to negotiate with Carter really on behalf of extraction companies, timber companies and other extraction companies, oil and gas. Carter would get down on the floor of the Oval Office and spread out maps and show him different things and try to show him how he was balancing all the interests. When Stevens came out of those meetings, on one of them, he was asked, you know, well, does it look like you're going to be able to strike some sort of accord with the president on the Alaska deal? And Stevens said, well, not right now. That son of a bitch knows more about my state than I do. So he had to go back to the drawing board and learn about it. But, you know, the people of Alaska at that time, they were bombarded with propaganda about from the oil and gas communities and the timber companies. And so they were dead set against Carter. And it really was something he did against his political interest. But he was thinking about my generation, my children's generation, the generations that come after. And they burned him in effigy in Alaska. They had two big pictures at the Alaska State Fair, one of President Carter and one of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And you could pay to throw bottles at them. And the glass shards underneath President Carter's picture were much higher than the Ayatollah's. But he went forward with it. In fact, on another one of his last trips through Alaska, he was going to Japan for a summit. And he said, let's stop in Alaska to see some friends. And one of his aides said, well, that's going to be a short list of people. you know, so it was tough for him, but he passed that. And there's a story in the book, I don't want to spoil it, but he went back to Alaska on the second to the last trip, a fishing trip of his life in this book. And he and Rosalind celebrated their 71st wedding anniversary there. And at the end of the trip, they stopped at a pizza joint. And this shows you, you know, when you talk about the entourage, it was very small. They went into this pizza joint. They had one or two Secret Service who had scoped it out, and everybody was in there just eating pizza, and it was mostly young people. They were tired, wanting to get back, flying commercially. He, you know, mostly flew commercial. They're trying to just relax and eat pizza. And I think, you know, to the extent that he had had all these encounters with Alaskans over the years, he probably wanted to keep a little bit of a low profile. So they just ate their pizza and drank some pitchers of beer until people slowly started to notice and recognize who they were. And eventually the restaurant, which was bustling with patrons, stood up and gave him a standing ovation because he did protect 150 million acres of Alaskan lands. And that has paid untold dividends for the people of Alaska and for our country. His environmental record really is one of the unsung things. If he had never done anything else in his life, the most lasting legacy he will leave, if we don't undo it, is the lands that he preserved. He doubled the size of our national park system at that time. He basically built half of our park system. The only person who preserved more was Teddy Roosevelt. And he honored Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, across party lines by creating Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
You mentioned about Teddy Roosevelt being a Republican and how Carter, you know, honored him anyway. That also seems to be a little bit of a theme in the book, is that places where he found common ground with people. I think the guy who owned the land in Pennsylvania where he fished year after year, was a lifelong Republican. And he runs into other people like that in the course of the book, but they all seem to get along either just over fishing or they find common ground elsewhere, right?
That's right. So yeah, he and Wayne Harpster, best friends right up until the Carter's passing. We still fish with Wayne. Wayne and Jimmy Carter had a lot in common. Wayne was a lot younger, about 10 years younger than Jimmy Carter, maybe a little bit younger even than that. But he was a farmer, and Jimmy Carter is a farmer at heart. His rural upbringing and his life as a farmer after being in the Navy and before becoming a politician really shaped who he was. So he always identified with farmers. And, you know, farmers tend to be more conservative people. And his people that he grew up around were more conservative people and didn't see the world through the same lens that he did. But I think the land ethic was a common bond. And then he also was a pragmatist. He would reach across party lines to get things done. He and Senator Howard Baker, Republican from Tennessee, were the ones who worked together to make the Panama Canal deal pass through. It wouldn't have happened without Senator Baker doing what he did. And Senator Baker sacrificed his political career in doing so as well. He would have been nominated for the Republican Party presidential race and would have been Jimmy Carter and Howard Baker head to head instead of Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan head to head if Reagan wasn't able to bludgeon Baker with "You gave away the Panama Canal" line of talk. In fact, I know a little bit personally about that because my first job as a lawyer was for Howard, Senator Howard Baker. I was in his law firm. I remember asking him about it, and he said that Jimmy Carter was absolutely relentless.
When we come back, Jim Barger Jr. talks about how former President Carter refused to cash in on the presidency.
You know, most of these presidents make millions of dollars per speech. He did a lot of speeches, but he never took a penny for them.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Jim Barger Jr. Rosalynn Carter, as you said, is in this book quite a bit, went on most of these trips and fished on most of these trips, and a very good angler herself. But the part about her that stuck out to me the most in this book was the arguments that she and Jimmy would have over him going to Walmart.
Yeah. President Carter loved Walmart. And the main reason he loved it is because he was thrifty, and that is putting it kindly.
I think in the book somewhere, that's where he bought most of his clothes after he was president.
He bought all of his clothes at Walmart. If you look at pictures of Jimmy Carter, you can tell, you know, he's wearing jeans, Dickie jeans and things like that, that he'd get at Walmart. He thought Walmart was a place that could bring a lot of goods quickly to people in rural areas at a price that they could afford. And he admired that. On the other hand, you know, Rosalynn thought that Walmart didn't pay its employees enough, didn't offer, you know, give them enough hours where they would be required to offer benefits, that they use cheap goods made in China. Their presence in small towns destroyed the local downtown areas by, you know, all of the arguments you have. So they both had these back and forth viewpoints about that. Now, of course, President Carter was the one who opened and normalized relationships with China. And so some of these, he recognized the value of a world economy and how it benefited. So yeah, they could really spar about those things, and they both had meritorious arguments, and then they both got into the, prayed together at night and got in the same bed at night, but they had some heated arguments about those things.
One thing you mentioned in the book is that they basically lived off, he didn't get paid for any speeches. They lived off of book royalties and I guess the pension for being president, right?
He and Rosalynn refused all speaking honorariums. You know, most of these presidents make millions of dollars per speech. He did a lot of speeches, but he never took a penny for them. He was adamant that he would not profit off the presidency. He wrote 32 books. He was a very prolific writer. And Rosalynn wrote a few books. Her book, First Lady of Plains, is one of the finest memoirs I've ever read. His early memoir, An Hour Before Daylight, I also would say is one of the finest memoirs I've ever read. You know, the quality of the writing in the is astounding. So they did get royalties from their books, and that was it. They had the farm, but the farm was really on the verge of bankruptcy when they came out of the presidency. He had turned it over to a trust. He was able to build the farm back up to be worth something. He also invested in his hometown. He built he and Rosalynn built the first solar farm there on their own property. And it feeds most of the town, that it's electricity. You know, he famously put solar panels on the White House when he was there, and the next president famously took them down and said they were a joke. But he was far ahead of his time on all of that. And so, yeah, but in terms of thriftiness, yeah, no, they lived in the same house that they left the presidency, a small ranch-style home. I visited with them there. It reminded me of the house I grew up in that my parents still live in. The only difference was most of the furniture in that house, in the Carter's house, President Carter made himself in his woodworking shop.
So what was that like? Did you talk to them for the book, or you?
Yeah. So the first time I met the Carters, I was 6 years old. They were coming down to St. Simons after winning the presidency. He came here to gather his first cabinet. It was Barrier Island off of his home state that he was familiar with, and he had friends who had helped him with his campaign. He was kind of a known quantity here, so it wasn't strange to be in a group of kids being babysat with the president's daughter and Secret Service coming back and forth, staying with friends who were friends of the president. But I didn't interact with them over all these many years later until we decided to write the book, and then visited with them at their home in Plains. They weren't leaving home at all after that. But it was a real privilege to be able to spend time with them and Dr. Hicks. And we all visited together and talked about writing. We talked about fishing. We talked about politics.
And obviously, just a couple of months before your book came out, in late December of last year, President Carter died. Did Dr. Hicks go to the memorial, or did you or?
Yeah, we did not go. I mean, I would not have been close enough within the entourage to be invited to that. Dr. Hicks was asked to be a pallbearer and was asked to come, but he said being asked was enough for him. He wanted the memories he had of his friend. He didn't really want to sit in a bus for 2 hours until they told him when to go into the church and where to sit. And so he did not. He declined to go, but he was thankful to be asked. That day, you know, the world stopped and watched that. I talked to Dr. Hicks throughout the day, but I really couldn't bring myself to sit and watch it. It was just, I know it was a beautiful thing, and I know his grandson did an amazing job, but I just needed to be kind of out in nature and walking around instead of looking at the television on that day.
I want to wrap it up with this. toward the end, there's a quote that you use, kind of a famous quote from Henry David Thoreau. Many men go fishing all their lives without knowing that it's not fish they are after. Do you think Jimmy Carter knew what he was after when he was fishing? And if so, what was it?
Well, I'll tell you, his answer would have been probably, I was after fish. But I think, you know, deeper than that, there was a connection to nature and a connection to his personal childhood. As a, you know, he was raised at a particular time that's hard for us to really imagine now, when the world was a much wilder place, and he was raised by his father, who took him fishing in the Okefenokee Swamp on extended trips. But he was mostly, his angling hero and mentor was a sharecropper named Rachel Clark. She was a black sharecropper that lived in the community of Archery. The Carters were the only white family in Archery. And he considered Rachel Clark to be his third parent, and maybe his first parent in some ways. He spent a lot of time in their home. He slept in their home a lot of times on a pallet on the floor. He felt like that was where he was raised. And Rachel Clark was, he said, was the finest angler he ever knew. She taught him how to fish. And they fished, you know, to bring meat home to the table. So I think, you know, I like to think that when he was in those contemplative states, he was trying to reach back to those moments of his early childhood, his connection to the land, his connection to the water. But also, you know, it happens with most of us who are anglers, when you fish, you have to concentrate on the act of actually feeding a fish what they want to eat and the way they want to eat it, which is a communion with nature that's different than every other type of communion with nature that we have. Bird watching is something that I love to do and that the Carters love to do, but it's passive. Most hunting is either actively flushing something or passively waiting for it and hiding from it. But in fishing, you have to try to engage the fish and give them exactly what they want. And when you do that, all of your other thoughts and worries have to take a back seat, and your subconscious is able to work on the problems that it's facing in a much more peaceful way. And I'm confident President Carter was seeking that kind of peace. You know, he was a peace seeker after all. That's what he was always after, and whether it be for countries or among people, but also for himself. And I think one of the best ways to find peace is next to the water.
Let's just say that you could draw quite a few contrasts between Jimmy Carter and the current occupant of the White House. One difference has to do with how they spend their time outdoors. The current occupant famously loves golf, and according to his scorecard, is very good at it. Golf is a beautiful sport, and I watch the Masters every year. But as gorgeous as a golf course can be, every hole required grading and bulldozing the wild land that had been there before, tearing up trees, maybe putting a little dye in a creek to make it look pretty on TV. Jimmy Carter preferred wild spaces. Of course, as a former president, his very presence made them less wild. It's hard to get fully back to nature when you know the Secret Service is around the corner. But he liked fishing in places that required climbing a steep ridge or rafting through rapids or battling mosquitoes the size of seagulls. He understood the value of leaving some places the way they are, instead of trying to tame everything, to bend all of nature to human desires. Of all the legacies he left, the national parklands created under his name might be the greatest. Jimmy Carter was a conservationist. You might even call him a conservative, back when that word meant something very different. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Eli Portillo and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.